Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 resident, ultimately going into radiology. This is the 45th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts, and this is actually the second installation of the Neurology Shelf Reviews. I'm going to try to complete a series. I do have a lot of content I want to go through, but I've been on a surgery rotation for the past like 3-ish weeks, and it's been a little more time consuming than I imagined. So as many of you that are listening to this probably know, surgery is not the easiest rotation in the world. Okay, so let's begin. So slide one, CSF findings in herpes, meningitis, and encephalitis, right? So the big thing I just want to draw out here is that if you do a lumbar puncture in a patient that has like a herpes brain infection, classically they would have a lot of red blood cells. So that's something you want to look out for. And usually the number of red blood cells are like less than 1,000. It's usually like 400, 500 on exams. If the number of red cells are like 4,000 or 5,000 or some astronomical number, you probably want to rethink the HSV thought and probably go more along the lines of a subarachnoid hemorrhage. And remember, because herpes is a viral infection, right, your white cells will obviously be elevated in the CSF, but you will not have a predominance of neutrophils. You have a predominance of lymphocytes, and your protein will be mildly elevated, your glucose will be mildly decreased, okay? But most things will be normal. But remember, you have a lymphocytic pleocytosis and you have a lot of red cells in the CSF. And don't forget that herpes, right? It classically affects the temporal lobes of the brain, right? You usually, if you take CSF, you can do like a PCR, like nucleic acid amplification of like CSF to make the diagnosis of HSV. I mean, you can also do a viral culture, but most people just do PCR because it's just quicker, makes more sense to do. And obviously you treat HSV encephalitis with acyclovir, usually give IV acyclovir. And just one quick thing, I'll just chip in here, right? So if a patient has meningitis and they want you to think about some kind of like brain abscess as a complication, remember the classic triad of a brain abscess, right? So that's like fever, headache, and neurologic deficits. If you see those three things, and usually in the question, they'll be very apt at pointing out that there is no nuchal rigidity, think about a brain abscess in that situation. Now, the second question, the classic presentation of bacterial meningitis, right? So this is usually, again, a sudden onset, like nuchal rigidity, really nasty headache, high fevers, chills, just the patient will certainly look toxic. And the CSF findings in bacterial meningitis, right? So it's a bacterial infection. So obviously your white count should be high and it should be a predominance of neutrophils, not lymphocytes, neutrophils. TB is the only bacterium that is associated with a lymphocytic pleocytosis on CSF studies, at least that you need to know for the USMLEs. I'm sure there's probably more. And so the white count is high in bacterial meningitis, is predominantly neutrophils. The protein will be very high, right? And the glucose will be very low because, again, think of all that inflammation, those cells and the bacteria and all that stuff, they're just chopping up the glucose. Now, the most common cause of meningitis in neonates, right? That's group B strep. Remember, group B strep causes most notable infections in neonates. And then if you're told about the classic cause of meningitis in a sexually active young person with skin petechiae, well, hopefully you're thinking about Neisseria meningitis. Okay, remember, it's a gram-negative organism. It's a gram-negative diplococcus. Okay, and the way you treat Neisseria meningitis, right, you give ceftriaxone. Remember, ceftriaxone is a third-generation cephalosporin. Although in neonates, you don't want to give ceftriaxone because it's associated with intrahepatic cholestasis. So you want to give like baby ceftriaxone under those circumstances, which is cefotaxime. And just while I'm on this right now, cefotaxime is a common answer choice on exams for spontaneous bacterial peritonitis. So it's just one of those all things you want to sort of keep at the back of your mind because it actually covers many gram negatives pretty well. Now, I've talked about the way you treat Neisseria meningitis, right? And one thing I'll just say is, I actually talked about this in the antibiotic guide, right? But if you have a neonate, right, or like an infant that has meningitis, or you have a patient that's older than 50 that has meningitis, right, you classically give them a 3-drug cocktail, right? So you give ceftriaxone, right? You give vancomycin to cover Staph aureus and like resistant strep pneumo, and then you give ampicillin to cover listeria, right? But classically, if a patient is like less than 50 years old and they are not like neonates, you can give them like ceftriaxone and vancomycin and call it a day. You don't necessarily need to give ampicillin because listeria as a cause of meningitis is rare in that population. But remember, if a patient has bacterial meningitis, especially from strep pneumo, you also want to go ahead and add in steroids like dexamethasone. In fact, many times it's recommended that you give the steroids before the first dose of antibiotics. That actually helps with decreasing the morbidity and mortality associated with bacterial meningitis, right? So like hearing loss after that episode. And if a person is a close contact of a patient with Neisseria meningitidis, you actually want to prophylax in those people, right? Remember, you can use one of three things, and the way to remember that is RCC. Okay, so the R stands for rifampin, the C stands for ciprofloxacin, and the second C stands for ceftriaxone. Of all those three, if you got an exam question where they listed all three of those, go with rifampin. Rifampin is the preferred agent. Now, Neisseria meningitis is actually preventable, right? I mean, generally, if you're about to go off to school, so usually around like the age of 16, it's actually recommended by, I think it's like ACIP. It's like some committee on immunization practices or whatever it's called, right? They do recommend Neisseria meningitis vaccination because Neisseria is actually pretty rapidly fatal if it's not treated. You can see people like they have leukorigidity and boom, they're dead within 24 hours. Now, Neisseria, right? So what's your diagnosis if the patient becomes profoundly hypotensive, hypoglycemic, hyperkalemic, and bleeds from every side, right? So hopefully you're thinking about a complication known as a Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, right? So basically this is just adrenal hemorrhage from involvement of basically like Neisseria like finds its way to the adrenal glands. So you can basically have like a primary adrenal insufficiency from that, right? So if you're not making cortisol, right, you become hypoglycemic. Remember, cortisol is a diabetogenic hormone. If you're also not making cortisol, right, you become hypotensive because remember, cortisol has a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system. And then, because you're not making aldosterone, right, you become hyperkalemic, right? So if you go back to renal physiology, at the level of the principal cell, right, remember, sodium comes in through an INEC channel, potassium is extruded and wasted in the urine. That INEC channel, its activity is promoted by aldosterone. So if you have an aldosterone deficiency because you have a primary adrenal insufficiency from Waterhouse-Friderichsen, you don't reabsorb sodium, you don't create that negative charge in the urine side that draws out potassium, so you become hyperkalemic, right? And just as an aside, remember, if a patient has primary adrenal insufficiency, they'll also have a metabolic acidosis, right? Because that proton pump at the level of the alpha intercalated cell doesn't work, right? So they will have a non-anion gap metabolic acidosis, and because it's a hypoaldosterone state, it'll be a type 4 renal tubular acidosis. And just as an aside, remember that if a patient is asplenic, right, if you don't have a spleen, you have a high risk of nasty, nasty like infections with encapsulated organisms like Neisseria meningitidis, right? So if they describe like life-threatening like meningitis in a kid that has like sickle cell disease, for example, right? Think about strep pneumo for starters, but also don't forget Neisseria meningitidis because it's actually an encapsulated bug. And also, please do not forget that patients with terminal complement deficiencies, right? So like C5 to C9 deficiencies, they also have an increased risk of recurring Neisserial infections. And one other high yield thing, right? If a patient is being treated for PNH, right, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria with eculizumab, right? Remember, it's a C5 inhibitor. You are essentially inducing a pharmacologic terminal complement deficiency. It is actually recommended that those patients get Neisseria meningitidis vaccines, right? So they don't get life-threatening infections. Now, next slide says the next best step in management of a 25-year-old male who is actively having generalized tonic-clonic seizures. He was started on intranasal desmopressin, whoops, 5 days ago after a water deprivation test that was conducted at the local hospital. Right, so desmopressin is an ADH analog, right? So this patient basically got a ton of ADH, right? So they've reabsorbed a ton of water at the principal cells using the vasopressin V2 receptors, right? So they essentially have hyponatremic seizures, right? So if a patient has seizures from hyponatremia, this is one of the few scenarios where hypertonic saline is indicated on tests. Usually they will make the sodium less than 120. They'll tell you the patient is having seizures. You do give hypertonic saline. Normal saline is not going to cut it at this point. So you give hypertonic saline, and remember that you don't raise the sodium by more than 12 milliequivalents per liter within the first 24 hours, right? Because again, as you'll see in the later part of this slide, right, you don't want to reverse hyponatremia too quickly, right? If you've read first aid for any reason, you probably remember the mnemonic that from low to high, the pons will die, and from high to low, the brain will blow, right? So if you correct hyponatremia too quickly, you can have osmotic demyelination syndrome. That's classically known as a central pontine myelinolysis. You don't want that, right? Because that can present as the locked-in syndrome. Alternatively, if a patient has like severe hypernatremia, right, you also don't want to correct that too quickly because that can cause like cerebral edema, and then you can have like a transtentorial herniation and the patient can die, right? So you also don't want that pretty much. So the general management strategy with electrolyte imbalances is you want to correct the electrolyte imbalance, but you want to go slow. You never want to fix anything too quickly, right? You don't want to overwhelm the body's homeostatic responses. Now, the next slide, bizarre dreams just after getting up from sleep, right? So that's a hypnopompic hallucination. And just before going to sleep, that's a hypnagogic hallucination. And then they tell you that the patient has a history of three major accidents from falling asleep at the wheel, whoops, plus sudden falls from lower extremity weakness, right? So that's cataplexy, right? So if you see all these things together, I really hope you're thinking about narcolepsy, right? And the way you make the diagnosis of narcolepsy, right, just like any other sleep disorder, you have to do a sleep study, right? So the buzzword you're looking for in exams is polysomnography. And your findings on polysomnography, right, is that they will have a decreased sleep latency. So those are the kind of people, they lie on the bed and boom, they go straight into REM sleep. And the way you treat narcolepsy, right, you can do a couple of things, right? So they should have like frequent naps during the day. You can give them stimulants like modafinil, right? That can help with like making them like wakeful during the day, if you may. If for the cataplexy, right, where they have like sudden loss of muscle tone, usually on exams, the answer they go after is sodium oxybate. But you can actually use tricyclic antidepressants and SSRIs for that purpose as well. But on exams, think mostly about sodium oxybate. And in terms of CSF deficiencies in patients with narcolepsy, they actually have low levels of something known as hypocretin. Okay, hypocretin levels are low in patients with narcolepsy. Now, while we're on that thought, right, what's the drug that's used in the treatment of insomnia that utilizes this pathophysiology? Right, so the drug is known as a suvorexant, right? So think about it this way. If having a hypocretin deficiency makes you sleepy, right, aka have narcolepsy, you can imagine that if a patient is an insomniac, maybe blocking hypocretin receptors, right, to sort of like pharmacologically induce a hypocretin deficiency could make those people sleep better. That's how suvorexant works. I believe it's known as Belsomra, if I'm not mistaken. That's like the trade name. It's basically a hypocretin receptor blocker that's used to treat insomnia. And again, I've talked about how you treat cataplexy in narcolepsy. Okay, so next slide. Severe headache plus multiple extraocular muscle deficits plus a recent history of otitis media. This is something you probably just want to be able to recognize on a test, right? So this is cavernous sinus thrombosis. Okay. Remember, the cavernous sinus transmits a lot of the cranial nerves that are associated with innervating the extraocular muscles, right? So like in the middle of the cavernous sinus, you have the internal carotid artery traversing with the abducens nerve. That's cranial 6. Remember, that controls the lateral rectus muscle, which is involved in abduction of the eye, abduction. Okay. And then on the side of the cavernous sinus, you have cranial nerve 3, right? And then you have cranial nerve 4, the trochlear nerve that does the superior oblique muscle. And then you have cranial nerve V1, right? So the ophthalmic nerve. And then you have cranial nerve V2, that's the maxillary nerve, okay? Those are all transmitted through the cavernous sinus, right? And again, they all control many multiple extraocular muscles. So if they describe a person that recently has like had like an upper respiratory infection or like a head and neck infection, and then they tell you that they have all these extraocular muscle deficits, you really want to think about a thrombosis of the cavernous sinus. And one reason that you can get thrombosis of the cavernous sinus is it has like this very like intense anastomosis with like ophthalmic veins that sort of supply some of the paranasal sinuses. So infections can very easily make their way from like your respiratory apparatus to the cavernous sinus. And the most common organism actually that's implicated as a cause of cavernous sinus thrombosis is Staph aureus. If I'm not mistaken, the second most common cause is strep pneumo. And really, the way you treat cavernous sinus thrombosis, you give antibiotics, okay? And then you also give heparin because it's a thrombotic disorder, right? And if you then were to get an, so this is probably more something that could show up on a neuro shelf or a medicine shelf even, right? So like severe headache, necrotic sinusitis in a patient with a blood glucose of 300, a pH of 7.13 and a bicarb of 15, right? So this is a patient in DKA. So hopefully you're thinking about mucormycosis, right? So like rhizopus or mucor species. Basically, the way you treat this is you have to like go in and debride and then give those patients amphoterol, okay, amphotericin B. It's like the only drug that can basically rescue these patients because this has a very high morbidity and mortality. Now, next slide, the classic presentation of Parkinson's disease, right? So Parkinson's is associated with an asymmetric resting tremor, right? There's also like the cogwheel rigidity. There's the festinating gait, right? And then there's the postural instability. Those are like the classic findings in Parkinson's disease. But there's other things you also find in Parkinson's disease, right? So like small handwriting, right? So the buzzword there is micrographia. They have like orthostatic hypotension, right? Because they have like autonomic instability and stuff like that. Okay, and really the pathophysiology of Parkinson's is you essentially have a destruction of the dopamine producing cells in the substantia nigra pars compacta, which is a part of the midbrain. Okay, and another potential thought behind the pathophysiology is people believe that Lewy bodies, right, so those things that are made of alpha synuclein, they sort of build up as intracellular inclusions in the dopamine producing cells in the substantia nigra. And remember, if a person has like abnormal inclusions in a cell, that can actually ultimately lead to cell death. So just something to keep in mind. And again, it's you have a depigmentation of the substantia nigra. That's the gross finding in Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's has a lot of treatments, right? So usually if a patient has like early Parkinson's, you want to go ahead and not jump straight to carbidopa/levodopa. You usually start with like amantadine, right? Amantadine is a drug that was used to treat the flu before, but apparently it increases the release of dopamine in the central nervous system, right? So you can start with amantadine. You can start with a dopamine agonist, right? So like you can start with a drug like bromocriptine or cabergoline. There's drugs like pramipexole, apomorphine. Those are all dopamine agonists. They can actually be used in the initial treatment of Parkinson's. Alternatively, you can use a monoamine oxidase B inhibitor like selegiline/rasagiline. Remember, monoamine oxidase B selectively breaks down dopamine. Okay, so by inhibiting that enzyme, your dopamine levels are sort of boosted, and you can treat Parkinson's. One other thing you can do is you can also use drugs like entacapone and tocapone, right? So remember, those are your COMT inhibitors. Entacapone works mostly in the peri. It works also works in the brain, but its major job is in the periphery. It doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier as much as tocapone. Tocapone has like a longer half-life. It's an awesome drug. Works great in the brain. Works great in the periphery. Only problem is that tocapone also kind of explodes your liver. So many people prefer to use entacapone for that purpose. I mean for that reason. But yeah, early Parkinson's, you basically try to use everything other than carbidopa/levodopa. Carbidopa/levodopa is what you kind of use as last line because it works for a few years and then it essentially becomes ineffective, right? Because of the on-off phenomenon that I discussed in the neuropharmacology podcasts. So that's how you treat Parkinson's in a nutshell. And the classic causes of drug-induced Parkinsonism, right? So you want to think of like your neuroleptics, right? Remember, those are dopamine receptor antagonists. You want to think about drugs like metoclopramide and domperidone. Remember, those are used as antiemetics, and they're also used to treat gastroparesis, classically in diabetics, right? So they have dopamine receptor blocking activity, so they could be used for those purposes. They could cause a drug-induced Parkinsonism. And then the anticholinergic that reduces tremors in Parkinson's, right? So remember from the neuropharmacology podcast, I essentially established an equation, if you may, that helps helps with understanding dopamine pharmacology. And this equation was that dopamine and acetylcholine have an inverse relationship. So if a patient has Parkinson's, right, they have low dopamine. So if dopamine is low, acetylcholine is high. And from those neuropharmacology podcasts, I sort of described how having high levels of acetylcholine may be associated with dystonias. So if a patient has like tremors in Parkinson's disease, right, you want to go ahead and give a drug like benztropine. Benztropine is a muscarinic receptor antagonist that could help with the tremors in Parkinson's. If they describe a question, this will probably be more of a side shelf question, but Parkinsonism in a young patient that took a drug at a party, right? You want to think about like improperly cooked opioids, right? So that potentially contain MPTP. MPTP is toxic to the dopamine producing cells in the substantia nigra. And in Parkinson's disease, right, on histology, you'll see like alpha-synuclein, right? So like Lewy bodies, they're like eosinophilic inclusions of alpha-synuclein. And I've talked about the super high yield side effects of levodopa/carbidopa, right? That's the on-off phenomenon, right? So like it takes a while to work, and then when it works, it just works for a short period of time. And I've talked about how you treat early Parkinson's disease. And remember, Parkinson's is a resting tremor, okay? And it's an asymmetric resting tremor, and it gets better with activity, the tremor in Parkinson's. Contrast that with an essential tremor. An essential tremor is symmetric versus Parkinson's that is asymmetric. Essential tremors actually get worse with activity, and actually essential tremors respond really well to propranolol. Now, if a patient is taking in a dopamine antagonist, right, so like a neuroleptic, right, and they have dystonias, right, you generally want to give a powerful anticholinergic like benztropine, or you can give an antihistamine like diphenhydramine that has significant anticholinergic activity. Another thing I also want to mention is, I'll just mention it here because it just comes up quite often on exams. If a patient has like a focal dystonia, so not like a generalized dystonia, like a focal dystonia, so let's say like one part of their face has like a dystonia, actually the treatment of choice under those circumstances is like Botox, right? Because it can sort of quiet down those muscles because you cause a decreased release of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, so those muscles don't fire, right? So again, you sort of remember when I said that acute dystonias are associated with high levels of acetylcholine, so that sort of ties in there, because by giving Botox, the botulinum toxin decreases acetylcholine release at the neuromuscular junction. And classically, like those focal dystonias, they describe it as being associated with, I don't really know how to pronounce the word, but it's called like a GEST, like GESTE, where they say like, oh, if they sort of massage the area, the dystonia sort of goes away. Just sort of keep that in mind, but classically you treat a focal dystonia with Botox. And then a relatively tricky question that comes up quite often on MBMEs is if a patient has a Parkinsonism and they're psychotic, right? So if a patient has like Parkinson's, right, those people already have low levels of dopamine. But if they have psychosis, you're like, how do I treat the psychosis? Because classically, psychosis is treated with dopamine receptor blockers, right? But you obviously know that's not a great thing in a patient that has a disease like Parkinson's that's associated with a dopamine deficiency, if you may. So for those patients, what you classically do on exams is if they told you in the Q-stem that, oh, they recently bumped their dose of carbidopa, levodopa, you may want to scale back the dose. But if that's not an answer choice, you may want to consider giving quetiapine. It's an atypical antipsychotic, but it has very weak dopamine receptor blocking activity. It's usually not a bad choice for the treatment of psychosis in a patient with Parkinson's disease. And then finally, if a patient with Parkinson's disease has a hypertensive crisis, right, you're thinking of that patient potentially being on an MAO-B inhibitor like selegiline or sertraline. Yes, I said those drugs only break down dopamine, but they also break down other catecholamines, okay? So you want to be careful. You don't want to combine like they can classically give you a question about a patient that has like Parkinson's and they have depression and you're trying to give them like an MAOI, like phenelzine or tranexamic or isocarboxazide. That can very easily trigger a hypertensive crisis. And remember, those hypertensive crises, you treat those with phentolamine. Basically, you give an alpha-1 blocker. Now, next question, 35-year-old female with a BMI of 35 plus visual difficulty plus intermittent severe headaches plus treatment for acne vulgaris. Right, so hopefully you're thinking about pseudotumor cerebri. The new term is idiopathic intracranial hypertension. I hate when they change the names of things, but IIH or pseudotumor cerebri, right? And basically, I just give you like the classic risk factors, right? So like obese female, pseudotumor cerebri can show up in guys on tests, but can show up in guys in the real world, but not on MBMEs. It's almost always in a female, okay? With a large BMI, okay? And they have visual difficulty because of those increased pressures, especially around the optic nerve. And usually on in exam questions, they'll tell you that they have like signs of papilledema on a fundoscopic exam. And vitamin A derivatives, right, classically that I used to treat acne vulgaris, also like risk factors for IIH, right? Also tetracycline based antibiotics also have that as a risk factor. Also risk factors for the development of pseudotumor cerebri. And the way you make the diagnosis is usually like you see like signs of papilledema on a fundoscopic exam. You're like, oh no, this patient has increased ICP. So you do a CT scan first, right? But you do the CT scan, things look relatively normal, right? So you then do the LP and you see the elevated opening pressures. Usually the cutoff is like 250 or something like that. If you see elevated opening pressures, that's pseudotumor cerebri. And generally you can treat it with like lumbar punctures, like therapeutic lumbar punctures. Alternatively, you can also give acetazolamide, right, to decrease the production of CSF. So next slide, because I'm sort of scared that I may be pitched for something soon. So let me quickly run through this. Okay, so 41-year-old male presents with a 1-year history of forgetfulness and behavioral changes. His father had a similar presentation before he died at the age of 47, right? So this is Huntington's. Okay, remember, it's a trinucleotide repeat disorder. And the pathophysiology, right, involves you basically have degeneration of the striatum. If you want to be a little more specific, it's the caudate nucleus that atrophies in Huntington's disease. And remember, it's associated with CAG repeats, okay? It's a chromosome 4 issue, and it's autosomal dominant inheritance, and it actually illustrates the genetic principle of anticipation, where like you get a more severe presentation and an earlier presentation as you go further in as you create like new generations. And really the way you treat Huntington's is with things that have anti-dopamine activities like haloperidol, okay, or you can give tetrabenazine. Remember, tetrabenazine is a VMAT inhibitor, so that basically depletes your pool of dopamine. And one other thing I just want to say, because I think someone asked me this question recently, it's usually pretty annoying to memorize like, oh, this disease is autosomal dominant, this disease is autosomal recessive, blah 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 blah, yada yada yada. So it's pretty annoying, right? But the thing is, there are some general principles that may help. They don't work all the time, but they work pretty well. Most trinucleotide repeat disorders are autosomal dominant inheritance. They're like two high yield exceptions, right? If I'm remembering correctly, Friedreich's ataxia is one. That's an autosomal recessive inheritance. And then Fragile X syndrome, right? Fragile X has an X in the name, right? So that should hopefully help you remember that it's like inherited in an X-linked fashion. Many structural disorders, right, are also inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? So like Marfan's, that's like a structural protein disorder. Hereditary spherocytosis, that's a structural red blood cell disorder. Those are classically inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. And then enzyme defects, right, are classically inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, okay? So hopefully those principles kind of help you remember, just sort of like make educated guesses on exams. Now, Slide 9, worst headache of a patient's life. This is a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? And in the question I say, on physical exam, bilateral flank masses are palpable, right? So this is basically ADPKD, autosomal dominant polycystic kidney disease. Remember, these patients classically on exams can have aneurysms in the circle of Willis, right? Most commonly in the anterior communicating artery. And the murmur that you auscultate at the apex between S1 and S2 is mitral valve prolapse, okay? Remember, mitral valve prolapse has an association with ADPKD. And really, the next best step in management, right, because this is a subarachnoid hemorrhage, this is a hemorrhagic stroke, the first thing you do is this non-con head CT, right? So the CT is kind of the head without contrast. And usually that will show you blood, like a hyperdense lesion, right? You see that and you're like, oh, okay, brain bleed, hemorrhagic shock, right? I mean, hemorrhagic stroke. So you generally like try to decrease blood pressure and all that stuff. But assuming like you have a strong suspicion for subarachnoid hemorrhage and the head CT, the non-con head CT is negative, you want to go ahead and get an LP, right? And you're looking for xanthochromia, right? The LP is actually pretty sensitive for a subarachnoid hemorrhage. So if you have a negative non-con head CT, you proceed to a lumbar puncture and you're looking for xanthochromia. And the treatment strategies, again, you try to lower blood pressure. You try to keep it like around like 140 over like 90 or something like that. You don't want it high, right? Because you don't want like more hemorrhage in the brain. Please don't give TPA for a hemorrhagic stroke. You'll have a lawsuit on your hands. That's like not prudent. And then, because I mean, right, you don't want to give a clot buster if a person is bleeding, right? That doesn't sound like a very good idea. And then preventing superimposed ischemia, right? You want to give a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Classically on exams, that would be nimodipine, okay? Helps pretty well with preventing post-stroke vasospasm, post-hemorrhagic stroke vasospasm that can sort of trigger like a superimposed ischemic stroke on the hemorrhagic stroke that just happened. Now, the final slide, the headache syndromes, right? So cluster headache, right? So this is the headache that is usually associated with like rhinorrhea, right? Like unilateral like rhinorrhea and unilateral like conjunctival like injection, right? So like tearing and all that stuff shows up at like the same time every day for days or weeks on end, right? Tension headache. And remember, cluster headache, right? You can abort it very quickly with inhaled oxygen. Tension headaches, these are the ones you get from studying too hard, basically, right? So it's usually like bilateral. It's worse at the end of a hard day's job, let's say like on a surgery rotation, for example, or you're studying for step 2 CQ or step 1. And then and those usually respond to NSAIDs, right? And then a migraine headache, right? It's the one that's usually unilateral, but it could be bilateral. It may or may not be associated with an aura. Most migraines are not associated with auras. A migraine, right, is classically worsened by loud noises and loud, bright lights, right? So like photophobia and phonophobia. And it's usually pulsatile, right? And basically, the patient has to like rest in a dark room to sort of feel better, right? And remember migraines, right? If a patient has an acute migraine attack, you can treat that with somatriptan or ergotamine, right? So somatriptan or ergotamine. Remember, somatriptan is a serotonin receptor. Oh, this is weird. This is not good. Somatriptan, if I'm not mistaken, it is a serotonin receptor antagonist. Wow, this is terrible. I love pharmacology. How do I not know the mechanism of action of somatriptan? But yeah, for now, we'll say it's a serotonin receptor agonist. Yeah, I remember. It's a serotonin receptor agonist. Yeah, because it can trigger serotonin syndrome. That's how I remember. So it's a serotonin receptor agonist. Okay. It's used to acutely treat migraines. So here's what they will try to do to you on a test. They tell you, oh, patient has more than 8 or 9 migraine attacks a month, right? So more than 8 is like the cutoff for where you need to prophylax these people. And then they try to trick you into giving somatriptan for prophylaxis. That is not a good idea, right? So if a patient has an acute migraine attack, you can give ergotamine, you can give somatriptan, no issue. But if you're trying to prophylax against migraines, classically on exams, you want to give propranolol, okay? Non-selective beta blocker. Remember, you don't want to give that to a patient with a history of asthma, right? That's not a stellar idea because you can get a bronchoconstriction and that'll be bad. Alternatively, you can also give like topiramate. That also works on tests. You can give a tricyclic antidepressant, right? Although remember, so like nortriptyline, amitriptyline, remember you want to avoid that in like the elderly, or you also want to avoid that in patients with a history of glaucoma, because tricyclics have anticholinergic activity, so they can cause mydriasis and decrease drainage through the canals of Schlemm. So prophylaxis migraine, like chronic prophylaxis migraines, beta blockers, tricyclics. You can give calcium channel blockers. You can give topiramate. Remember, topiramate is associated with nephrolithiasis and like mental slowing as side effects. But acute treatment, ergotamine, sumatriptan, that's all good. And then analgesic rebound headaches, just a person takes a ton of analgesics, they have headaches, you need to just wean them off those analgesics. It would not be pretty for the first few days, but it will get better as time goes on. And then headache and mental status changes in December in an 83-year-old female who uses an old space heater, right? So hopefully you see this as carbon monoxide poisoning. I mean, generally, right, you want to go ahead and give like hyperbaric oxygen or like high flow oxygen, right? Because that decreases the half-life of carbon monoxide bound to hemoglobin, right? And remember, for these patients, pulse ox is not a great idea on the test, because I mean, pulse ox does not distinguish between oxygen bound to hemoglobin. So like, basically, it does not distinguish between hemoglobin that is saturated with oxygen versus hemoglobin saturated with carbon monoxide. Okay, so you generally want to check carboxyhemoglobin levels, and that will give you a more definitive diagnosis. And this is just a low yield, it's like low yield, but it's just one of those bizarre things that may pop up on an exam. Remember that carbon monoxide poisoning is actually associated with hyperintense lesions in the globus pallidus on imaging, on MR imaging. It's just one of those bizarre things you just want to file away in your mind for the future. Now, right-sided headache in a 35-year-old smoker that has occurred every day around 9 a.m. for the past month and blah, 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 blah. I already talked about this. That's a cluster headache, right? And then the high-yield contraindication to a common migraine med, right? So basically here I'm talking about sumatriptan, right? So the contraindications, right? So remember, I believe I mentioned this in the neuropharmacology podcast that vasoconstriction is good for headaches, but it's vasodilation is bad for headaches, right? So sumatriptan, right? Imitrex, basically. It's a serotonin receptor agonist. It can cause vasoconstriction. Sumatriptan is not good for people with a history of vasospastic disease, right? So if a patient has a history of like Prinz metal angina, also called, at least the new term is variant angina, you don't want to give them sumatriptan. If they have coronary artery disease, no sumatriptan. If they have like Kress syndrome, right, like Raynaud phenomenon, no sumatriptan. That's not a good idea because they all have a vasospastic disease. Sumatriptan is a vasoconstrictor, not good for those people. And then because sumatriptan is also a serotonin receptor agonist, remember it could trigger serotonin syndrome, right? So you don't want to give like sumatriptan with like linezolid, for example, which is an MAOI, right? Because it, linezolid being a weak MAOI, it can sort of boost your levels of serotonin, right? You also don't want to give sumatriptan with like an SSRI or an SNRI or an MAOI or a tricyclic or what else? There's one more drug I'm thinking about. Come on, think. Let's see. Sorry, I'm sort of giving this from memory. Yeah, the MAOB inhibitors that are used to treat Parkinson's, right? Again, yes, those inhibit prevent the breakdown of dopamine primarily, but you can also get into trouble with those because they also, at least partially, break down some catecholamines. And then actually another unusual one is like entacapone, tocapone, right? Yes, they are COMT inhibitors, but they can actually also trigger serotonin syndrome. So again, the short gist here is you don't want to mix two serotonergic medications together. So this is the end of today's podcast. I'll probably pick up with this in the next podcast. I'm just going to try to make a series of podcasts to sort of finish up this NeuroShelf review. So this is part two. Look out for part three in the future. I'll have to go now. Thank you for listening. If you have any questions, please drop me a line. Hopefully after my surgery rotation, I should be able to pump out more content because I certainly have a lot of content in my mind. It's just literally no time to do this. I mean, many of you know how surgery rotations go. So have a wonderful day. It's an early day on Monday. Do your best, work hard, and God bless. Have a great day. Bye.